I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So a few weeks ago, I was at the beach. We were with friends, and when they went into the water, I volunteered to stay back with the kids. I had my little daughter with me and a couple of my five-year-old buddies, Lincoln and Lou. So they're playing in the sand by the bushes, and suddenly Lou starts freaking out. Like, she's terrified, and she's screaming, and she sees a bee. Bees! I hate bees! And she's just bawling, the poor thing, and so I go over and give her a hug and try to calm her down, and the bee finally flies away. And then Lincoln goes, "Bees are our friends. They make honey and they help the flowers." And I was so excited because Lincoln gets it. I mean, you know, we're going to have to work on him getting all like hashtag actually on a girl. But then my daughter for the rest of the week kept looking at flowers and saying, "Baba, bees make honey." Yes, yes, they do make honey. And it turns out they make a whole lot more than that.
Our primordial sweet tooth led us to bees and to following them to honey and hives. And the calories that we gain from that may indeed have helped bolster increase in brain size over time. So perhaps not responsible for human evolution, but along with hunting and cooking and other innovations, a contributing factor in what makes us who we are.
That's the biologist and author Tor Hansen, and this episode is all about the amazing world of bees. From how we love to eat what they make, to how tending them helps build human communities, to how their pollination prowess really affects so much of what we eat. And to talk about that, Tor is here with us. Hey Tor, thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So there's something that bee-loving people really like to say, and I love the sound of, and that is that bees are responsible for every third bite of food that humans consume. But in your book, you have a decidedly foodie way of illustrating what that actually means. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. Yeah, well, that statistic comes from looking at global crop production and the fact that, you know, fully 35% of that production either relies on or benefits from bee pollination. But I thought it would be interesting to look at the quality of food, not just the quantity, and try to dissect a meal looking for bee ingredients, but not just any meal, not just something that you would see at the farmer's market or the produce aisle, but something a little bit out of the way of the normal bee foods, and that was a Big Mac sandwich at McDonald's. And what I found was that, you know, there were a host of bee products involved in that hamburger. Things like pickles and even the lettuce and the onions get removed. And you still have a burger. You still have a meat patty from grass and grain-fed beef. And you can still have a bun from wind-pollinated grains. But the sesame seeds had to be picked off the bun. And even the special sauce had to go. I started looking at the ingredients. And you have a host of things in there, at least five ingredients that relied upon bees, from the paprika to the vegetable oils that give it its rich taste and texture. So the lesson that it taught me, Francis, was that yes, we could eat in a world without bees, but our food would be pretty dull and probably not very nutritious.
Yeah. It goes from to all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickle, onion, sesame seed bun, to like a sad burger.
Yeah. The jingle would never have caught on, you know, to all beef patties, bun. That doesn't work.
All right, so bees give us a lot, but in the book you argue that there's more, right? It almost sounds to me that pretty much everything we like in the plant world is because of bees.
Well, the one thing to remember right off the bat is how diverse bees are. We tend to immediately think of honeybees, but we're talking about a group that has more species than all the birds and all the mammals combined, and then some, over 20,000 species of bees in the world. Yeah, and that diversity stems in part from their close relationship with flowers. Bees and flowering plants co-evolved together, the diversity of one spurring diversity in the other. And because bees are solely reliant upon flower products for their own food and for the food they feed to their babies, the little larvae there back in the hive or the nest, they want that nectar and that pollen. And from the plant's perspective, they want to attract bee visitors to move pollen among flowers. You have this interesting coevolutionary relationship where each side influences the other. And flowers that we look at have adopted colors specifically to attract bee visitors. So many of the colors that we think of, you know, for flowers, the blues and the purples fall right in the middle of the bee's visible spectrum. And that is by design. That is what the flowers have evolved to do, is attract those bees in with the not only the colors, but the smells and the shapes of those flowers, all designed to attract and then manipulate the bees on the flower so that they move in a particular way that deposits pollen onto the bee and then removes that pollen onto the female parts of the flower or the next flower that the bee visits. So a lot of what we see in nature and take for granted is actually heavily influenced by bees.
Oh, that's wild. So if there were no bees, what would flowers look like? Like, or what would they smell like if they didn't have to attract bees?
Well, then you have to start looking at what some of the other flower visitors are out there. So if we get rid of bees, the flowers would be much more likely to have co-evolved with other insects like wasps and flies, for example, who are attracted to these musky terpenes and rotten flesh smells. You'd have all these dead meat-looking flowers out there. And there are a few examples of that. In nature, where the flowers look and smell like rotten meat to attract, say, flies of particular kinds for pollination. But they're quite rare because the bees are a much better bet. So it is a happy accident in nature that the smells and the colors and the shapes that we find beautiful are the ones that are attractive to bees as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, you're talking about flowering plants, and I think it's so important for us to remember that flowering plants aren't just flowers, like pretty flowers, like tulips, et cetera, et cetera. It's, you know, most of the fruits and vegetables that we eat are actually flowering plants, right? Like oranges flower, apples flower, zucchini flower.
Exactly. Huge range of things that you would see in the produce aisle, and some things that are less intuitive, even nuts. I mean, every almond that get in a bunch of mixed nuts there, that seed comes from a flower that was visited by a bee. It has to be bee pollinated. And things that are far less intuitive, like vegetable oils, when you think of canola oil, those are from mustard plants with big, you know, beautiful yellow flowers visited and pollinated by bees. And even some things like soybeans, which can self-pollinate, do much better if bees are present in those fields, 10 to 40% higher yields for bee-visited soybean flowers.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about a chapter in your book where you talk with a nutritional anthropologist, because this is a conversation that totally blew my mind. And she thinks we owe bees some credit for actually helping us evolve into humans.
Yeah, this is terrific stuff. It really is. When we talk about the human connection to bees, we often think of, you know, our long domestication of honeybees or even looking for wild honeybee nests and other bees in nature. So back, you know, thousands of years. But this anthropologist, Alyssa Crittenden, at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and colleagues that she works with have done some fascinating research and suggest that our connection to bees should be measured in the millions of years. And what they've done is study the dietary habits of the Hadza people, a hunter-gatherer group still living a very traditional hunter-gatherer subsistence lifestyle in East Africa, in the very landscape where our species is thought to have evolved. And in doing so, they've learned how much honey those people eat, not just honey, but also the larva and the pollen that's included in those honeycombs. We tend to think of that something like that as sort of a sweet occasional treat. But in interviewing people and observing the foods brought back to those camps at the end of a day's foraging, Alyssa was able to calculate how many of their calories were coming from honey. And over the course of a year, it was a full 15% of the calories in their diet, and at certain times of year, much higher than that, and even higher for the men who do most of the honey hunting, because they eat quite a lot of it before they even come back into camp. So this is, you know, a totally fascinating idea, because when you put it in an evolutionary context, you ask then the question, well, would our ancestors, living roughly the same lifestyle in the same landscape, have done anything different? Well, probably not. The people today, the Hadza out there, are looking for honey on a daily basis. It's their favorite food. They're always searching for the hives of honeybees and at least six other honey-producing species in that area. And we know that chimpanzees eat honey and other great apes. So why not Homo habilis and Homo erectus and even Australopithecus, these ancient ancestors who would have been in that same area looking for a sweet treat? And it becomes really powerful when you start to think about the impact of all those calories on ancestral humans, because the story of human evolution has always been a story of brain size. And the brain is what physiologists like to call metabolically expensive. It takes a lot of energy to run brain tissue. Fully, you know, 20% of our daily calories go to fuel the brain, which takes up, you know, only 2% or so of our body weight. So it is expensive to have a big brain. And every surge that we've seen in brain size over the eons of human evolution is thought to have been associated with a surge in calories, whether that be the advent of hunting or better tools for hunting or the advent of cooking, which provides more calories from the food, more accessible calories. So when you start to look at honey in that context, well, honey is the most energy-rich food in nature. And not only that, but it comes in large part in the form of glucose, which is what the brain uses. If you eat other things, your body will turn those starches or whatever into glucose to feed your brain, and you can get it straight out of honey. So this suddenly suggests that our primordial sweet tooth led us to bees and to following them to honey and hives, and that the calories that we gained from that may indeed have helped bolster increase in brain size over time. Because all of those same technological and social innovations that could lead to, you know, increases in hunting productivity or increases in calories from cooking, whether it's stone tools, well, of course, those will allow you access into the big hives of honeybees that are in trees. You can chop the tree open and get the honey. Well, if you need to master fire for cooking, well, that also gives you mastery over smoke, which you can use to pacify bees and get the honey. So there are all of these things now in the context of honey, which suggest it's, you know, perhaps not responsible for human evolution, but along with hunting and cooking and other innovations, a contributing factor in what makes us who we are.
Oh, this is so fascinating. Thank you so much, Tor. This has been really, really great to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Tor Hansen's book is Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Coming up, The Red Bees of Brooklyn and Other Mysterious Tales. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. In 2010, beekeeping became legal again in New York City, and apiaries bloomed from rooftop to shining rooftop. But urban beekeeping is kind of a wild hobby. It's estimated there are 500 beekeepers in the city, and there are tons of stories, like people who keep bees in the living rooms of their apartments, or people having to wrangle their bees so they don't bother Secret Service snipers who are setting up on rooftops. And maybe most famously, the mystery of the red honey of Brooklyn. Andrew Cote is the founder of the New York City Beekeepers Association, and he's seen it all. And a few weeks back, he took us out into his world, amongst the hives of New York City.
So, hey, Andrew, thanks so much for having us up here. This is incredible. We're on the 7th floor roof of One Bryant Park, which actually extends way higher than this, but we're on one of these mechanical roofs, which is like these secret spaces in New York City that you don't know about, and you can kind of look over and over and on top of things. And what are we going to do today?
Today we are going to open up these beehives, take a look, and see what goes on in this little box of calm that I keep on top of this building. So what we're doing here is we're lighting the smoker, and the smoke helps to calm the bees.
Okay.
So we're going to open up this beehive in a few minutes after we get the smoker puffing away nicely with big billowy clouds of smoke.
This thing looks like so old school. It looks like a Victorian fireplace where you got that big puffer. Like
this smoker and this type of beehive has been used for over 150 years, and I can think of very few industries that have changed so little.
Yeah.
The equipment that I'm using is the same type of equipment that my great-grandfather may have used. In fact, the type of beehive called the Langstroth hive is the same type of hive he used.
We are at one of your hives. You have many hives on rooftops all over the city.
I have about 102 beehives in New York City. I have them in each of the five boroughs. And urban beekeeping is a thing that's happening all over the world. I have beekeeping friends in Tokyo, Kyoto, Berlin, London, Paris, Hong Kong, quite a few places.
Yeah.
Melbourne.
And this is like an international community of beekeepers?
Well, thanks to the internet, we are an international community, and we exchange ideas and share our experiences. It's fun in Manhattan to have beehives in such an array of places. I've got beehives at the United Nations. I have them here right next to Times Square. I've got them on synagogues, churches, schools, in community gardens, on businesses of all stripes. So it's interesting and it's fun. And at the heart of it, it's all beekeeping. So the way I take care of this beehive here on top of this building is the same way that my grandmother took care of her bees in northern Quebec.
That's incredible. You can see the bees flying in and out of them. I've never been this close to this many bees in my entire life, and they're not even open yet.
This is the entrance down at the bottom. It looks something like a filing cabinet, maybe, these boxes. So a Langstroth beehive is the type of beehive that's used the most in this country, certainly. There are many, many types, but this is my preferred type. And the bees more or less work their way up. And we've got one box on the bottom that's going to be for them, for their babies, for their food, a second box also for the same. And then above that, there's a little metal screen called the queen excluder, and the queen can't get her childbearing hips through that.
Okay.
The other bees can. So they go up through there, and
you have two boxes above those.
Right, the boxes above those. So the queen, she lays the eggs. Only the queen lays the eggs. So in those boxes where the queen can't reach, we have only honey. That's honey harvestable by us.
Okay.
And so we take that.
Yeah. So now you're puffing that smoke into the box?
Yeah.
Or right around the box?
So the smoke will calm the bees down a bit. It'll distract them. Bees communicate via pheromones.
And now you're opening it.
Now I'm taking the lid off.
Lifting that lid. That is a lot of bees, dude. Wow.
So how many bees would you guess are in this hive?
I'm bad at numbers. That's why I became a writer. But let's call it 10,000? How close am I?
You're not very close. It's about 75,000 bees.
75,000 bees.
So look here, I'll pick this one up by her wings. And we'll see she has four wings, five eyes, three parts to her body. She has two stomachs, six legs, and one stinger that comes out of here.
Yeah.
The females can sting. The males cannot.
Okay.
Females make up 99% of this hive. These bees are the workers. They control the means of production. It's a real Bernie Sanders dreamland.
Real Karl Marx moment. Yeah. And so in this box, there are all these slats. You pull out the slats. There are bees working their way around them. Is that honeycomb? Is that actual honeycomb?
That's right. So these are, we call them frames.
Okay.
And on those frames, there's honeycomb. The bees built this comb in these hexagonal patterns, as you can see inside there.
It's beautiful.
We've got very damp nectar that hasn't quite yet been converted to honey.
Okay.
But here we have capped honey. And if I tear that open,
the honey just comes right out.
Comes right out.
Oh my God, it just oozes the moment you touch it with this blade. So you said you have 100 hives around rooftops in New York City.
That's right.
How much honey does that make?
Depends on the year. One good hive could produce 100 pounds of honey.
Wow.
Might produce nothing. It'll produce something in between.
Okay, so speaking of beekeeping in the modern world, I think when most people think of beekeeping, they think of this really bucolic, beautiful thing. Maybe you have a garden. You're here in New York City. What are some of the weird things that happen when you bring beekeeping into an urban environment like this?
So there's a maraschino cherry factory in Red Hook, Brooklyn. And it was founded in 1946. And the family tended to be a little bit cavalier about how they disposed of the high fructose corn syrup mixed with red dye number 40 that is used in part to make maraschino cherries. They would dump it onto the street. It would dribble down the road and go into the sewers.
It's like Amityville Horror. It's just like, this. Oh, that building is bleeding.
It was quite a sight if you were to go early in the morning and see it. So bees, they like sweet things, and they will go after nectar, of course, but if there's sugar water or high fructose corn syrup or antifreeze, which is sweet, then they'll go for that. And the bees won't really discern that that's not a healthy choice for them any more than our children will not discern that potato chips or cookies is not the right food for them.
Yeah.
Amongst other people, a woman named Cerise, which it's funny because that means cherry in French, her bees were bringing back what appeared to be red honey. And really, it was just the high fructose corn syrup mixed with the red dye number 40, but they were transporting it back in their honey stomachs. Bees have two stomachs, one to transport nectar. They were bringing it back to the hives and making what looked like red honey. Now, it had a strange metallic taste. It didn't taste good, and technically, it's not honey. But the cherry factory hired me to try to figure out the problem and see what he could do about it, and we solved it pretty easily by putting up screens and not allowing the bees access, not dumping the garbage in the street on a regular basis anymore. And there was a piece to the story that didn't immediately come into the public purview, which was the gentleman in question who ran the factory was also running a marijuana growing center underneath the cherry bottling facility. And that came to light when they closed in and arrested him for that. Unfortunately, he took his own life. But the red cherry honey, that was something else.
Yeah. And is it true that you have been asked by the Secret Service to control bees so their snipers don't get bothered when they're setting up?
Actually, I've had to deal with the Secret Service many different times. For example, I used to keep bees on top of the Waldorf Astoria. And the Waldorf Astoria was, until our most recent administration, where the sitting president of the United States would always stay.
Huh.
And for example, when Obama was there, he was very bee friendly. He had bees at the White House on the lawn. We would have to coordinate with the Secret Service in different ways when we wanted to tend to the bees. But the time that we had to deal with them most directly was when then Vice President Joe Biden was to visit a restaurant, a now defunct restaurant called the Bridge Cafe, down on the corner of Water and Dover. It's now gone. Hurricane Sandy took it away. But the snipers, the Secret Service needed to be on the roof of that building during that time, but we had beehives on the roof.
Yeah.
So they asked me to go up and screen them in, the beehives.
So the sniper can sit there and not get bzz, bzz, bzz all around.
I think that's what it was.
This is incredible, Andrew. Thank you so much for showing us your bees and telling us your stories.
Nice of you to make the time to come up here, and it's been fun for me. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Andrew Cote is a fourth-generation beekeeper and the president of the New York City Beekeepers Association. And if you want to find ways to use some of your honey, check out splendidtable.org. We've pulled together a bunch of killer honey recipes, like Melissa Clark's feta-stuffed phyllo tort. You can find them all at splendidtable.org. Most of us have some kind of honey in our kitchens, and usually it's either gathering dust in the back of a cupboard or just getting stirred into tea or yogurt, but it's not always something people reach for when they're cooking. So Sally Swift asked America's Test Kitchen's Bridget Lancaster what they know about cooking with honey.
Bridget. Great to have you back. I want to talk to you about honey today. Can we just start with something really basic? Like, can you explain the difference between raw honey and regular honey?
Sure. Yeah. You basically have two choices when you go to a supermarket. They're now starting to also sell raw honey as well as regular. But, you know, the clear, fluid, you can see right through it. Sometimes it's in a bottle shaped like a teddy bear. That's the regular.
Okay.
That's the kind I grew up with.
Right.
And then you have raw, and it's cloudy. You can't see through it at all. Sometimes it's almost white, like a butter. And that's raw honey. And the main difference is how they're treated. Raw honey is not cooked. So it's raw. And if it is cooked a little bit, it's just up to 120 degrees. And that's mostly so that it can be poured into a container. But raw honey still contains pollen. It might have a little bit of the wax still in it that you find from the hive. And it's got little crystals. The sugar started to crystallize in there. And that's what turns it that opaque kind of color, for lack of a better word. But the regular honey is the kind that you can see through. It's been heated to a much higher temperature. It's about 155 or higher. It's almost like pasteurization with milk. They want to kill off any yeast that's in there because the yeast might start to ferment the honey. And it also staves off crystallization.
Okay, so it's just a cleaned up version, essentially. I know that you guys have tasted some, and they taste different, don't they?
Yeah, they sure do. They really do. Wild honey tends to be really local, so there are fewer national brands of raw honey. And often they are what's called monofloral, and that means that all the flowers that were used, the nectar from the flowers, were from one certain type of flower. So you end up with very specific flavors in the raw honey that are sometimes, because it hasn't been filtered, it hasn't been heated, the flavors are still there. So you get more of that flavor. You get more of that floral flavor. But we really, really like raw honey.
Yeah, it has personality.
It does. And, you know, sometimes it's a little crunchy.
Yeah.
I love that because you can spread that on toast. It's got those little crunchy bits. It's almost like sea salt.
Yeah.
But it's mostly just the sugar starting to crystallize. That's
it. And what is the best way to deal with your honey when it gets solid?
Right. So even the regular honey sometimes likes to revert and crystallize and turn solid again. And people will say, oh, okay, you got to throw it out. Absolutely not. You don't have to throw it out. There are a couple ways to bring it back to that fluid state. So one thing you can do is scoop some out, put it in a glass bowl and microwave it for about 10 seconds at a time. You just want to stir it, make sure that it's heating evenly until it's nice and fluid. Or if you're going to use a whole bunch, say you're making something like a honey cake and you need cups of it at a time.
Right.
You would just take the container. It has to be a glass container for this to work. Put it in a saucepan with water, just a couple of inches of water, and heat that over low heat, and it'll start to remelt all those crystals, and you'll get a beautiful fluid honey.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about those single flower honeys, like you see Tupelo, and you see, I can't think of what else, buckwheat I've seen. Do you have an idea for us on what the different varieties taste like?
Well, usually there's a source on the side of the honey package that'll say what types of flowers were used, what the source is. So you're going to taste whatever the flower was that that honey was made from. So something like an orange blossom, it's going to taste very citrusy. Tupelo is a tree, and it has kind of a piney flavor, so you're going to get that. And buckwheat, buckwheat's actually, we found, was one of the stronger honeys. It almost has this malty flavor to it, like molasses.
It's darker, too, I seem to remember.
It is. And buckwheat itself has protein in it, so there are proteins in the honey that react with the sugars, and you end up getting this maltier flavor. It's a very strong flavor. So if you like a toasty honey flavor, it's great. Otherwise, sometimes people like that clean flavor, and they want to go with something a little bit more mild, like Tupelo or orange blossom.
Okay, so let's talk about cooking with honey. When should we be using it?
Well, what people should know is the more you cook honey, the less flavor it's going to have. So if you're making something like a honey cake, you're going to need to use a lot of it in order to get a little bit of flavor. But we found that honey, you picture things that are glazed. And I'm not talking like donuts, which I always think of, but things that are savory, chicken, pork, fish, things like that. So a glaze, we found that honey was one of the best ways to glaze just about anything. We had a recipe for a whole side of salmon, which is, you know, the piece of salmon itself, the thickness isn't that thick. It's maybe a half inch or so. So really the problem with salmon is overcooking it. You don't want to overcook it.
Right.
So If you cook it until it's just done, there's almost no color on the top. So we went in the kitchen. We were looking for different ways of adding color to the top, getting it to brown quicker. Mm-hmm. So we tried sugar because we like sugar. Mm-hmm. And sugar was really spotty. It didn't work very well. But honey was kind of amazing. We just brushed it on. It smoothed over the surface perfectly, and it browned evenly all over. And it has to do with the types of sugar. So sugar itself is basically just, you know, it's a disaccharide. It contains two specific sugars to make its own sugar. Mm-hmm. So when we think of a regular table sugar, it's basically sucrose. That's a disaccharide. But honey is monosaccharides. It's actually two monosaccharides that are still separate. They haven't combined to make sucrose. So in order for sugar to start to brown, it has to break down into those monosaccharides, and then it can start to brown. So that's why honey, because it's already in that state, will brown faster.
Honey's a step ahead.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, what is the best way for us to keep honey? Does honey go bad?
No, it's really hard. I've never seen honey go bad. I can assume that if you had raw honey that had a large amount of yeast in it, it might start to ferment.
Okay.
That has never happened to me. So for honey, we always tell people a cool spot in your pantry is great, mm-hmm. or you can actually freeze it. Freezing will stop all aging when it comes to honey, but it also stops the crystallization.
Huh. And does it get hard? Is it a frozen block?
You know, I call it a squishy solid. It doesn't freeze completely. It's really a strange, it's not like granita where you think, okay, it's almost frozen, but it's not. It's this weird, it's a squishy solid. You know, it's a good idea if you are going to store your honey in the freezer, not to store it all in one container. I would probably put in smaller batches, maybe 2 tablespoons, or even pour it into an ice cube tray. And, you know, you can heat it up if you want, or just let it sit at room temp and it'll pour beautifully.
Got it. Thank you so much, Bridget.
My pleasure.
Bridget Lancaster is host of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country. And you can find that recipe for roasted salmon for a crowd at splendidtable.org. Coming up, an update on keeping our honeybees happy and healthy. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Hey, it's time to talk, you and me. Get to us any way you like, 1-800-537-5252, or Facebook or Twitter, or you can always email us, contact@splendidtable.org. And let us know what you're working on in the kitchen, or what you're trying to figure out. All right, we have Lois calling from the City of Roses, Portland, Oregon. How are you, Lois?
I'm good.
What would you like to talk about?
Well, I was an excited participant at the pepper party you had a while back because I love spice. And last year I grew some habanero peppers and had a really great crop, and it's looking like we're going to have another good crop this year. And I'm just wondering, what's the best thing to do with them? Obviously, I get more than I can eat at once, and I'd love to have all of the flavor and heat to last through the year. So I tried making some of my own hot sauce, but I don't know whether cooking them before I put them in with vinegar, what vinegar to use. Do I want to put in other ingredients? Because I really want as much heat and flavor as possible. And in addition to hot sauce, I'm wondering if there's another way I should be trying to preserve some of them so that I could use them maybe in baking, because there's nothing better in the world than chocolate and spice together.
Oh, wow. Whew. Okay, so yeah, I love playing around with making hot sauces in different ways. Like you said, sometimes you cook them, sometimes they're raw, sometimes you just mix them with vinegar. Very, very, very simply, you can just douse them in vinegar. You know, you get a jar, you cut up the peppers, you throw them in there. This will be raw, and it'll be very, very much like the pure heat and the pure flavor, plus some vinegar. You cut them up, put them in a jar, and top it with vinegar, and that will preserve them for a good long time. You know, if you want to can them and seal them so you put it on the shelf, that's fine. Or, you know, if you want to be really safe about it and don't have to go through the process of canning, just throw them in your fridge. And I think peppers sitting in a jar of vinegar in your fridge will last a really long time. You can always fish them out, or you can pour out some of that vinegar, and that's a really great thing to use.
Great. And in terms of if I want to try some experiments with baking, is there a better option for which way I'm trying to preserve my peppers so that come February, if I decide to make a flaming Valentine chocolate cake or something.
Yeah. I might try to dehydrate the peppers. Mm-hmm. You can go out and buy a food dehydrator and, you know, follow the instructions. Or, you know, this is a little tricky because, again, you want to make sure it's going to dehydrate at the right rate and you don't get mold. But you can try, like, putting them in a low oven, like a super low oven. Maybe slice them in half, maybe seed them, you know, take the stems off, and put them in an oven as low as it'll go. I can't tell you exactly how long because it depends on how many peppers you have, how juicy they are, et cetera, et cetera. But just come back to it every couple hours and see when they've gotten to the point where they're really dry. If they're like brittle, you can throw those in a spice grinder and you have your own dried habanero pepper powder. And you can maybe use that for your baking.
Oh, that's fantastic. You have given me a habanero harvesting season's worth of activities to do and a year worth of spicy flavor to enjoy. So thank you so much, Francis. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. May the heat be with you.
I think it will be unavoidable.
Yeah. All right, great to talk to you, Lois. Thanks for the call.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, we have Miwa calling from New York. Hey, Miwa.
Hi. Hello, Francis.
Thanks so much for the call. What would you like to talk about?
Mm-hmm. Yes. A few weeks ago, I had extra celery and eggplant and decided to make caponata for the first time myself. And I started browsing recipes online. And the first recipe I happened to click, I was surprised that the list of the ingredients had 2 teaspoons of cocoa powder in it. And I wanted to know why, and some recipes call for cocoa powder and others don't for caponata.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So caponata is a wonderful dish. I love it. It's a Sicilian dish, usually with fried or browned chunks of eggplant, and they're sort of in this condiment of usually tomatoes and onions cooked down, celery, as you said, celery is an important part of it. And it's kind of like, it's almost like ratatouille in that it's got eggplant. It's a very summery thing.
Yeah, it's got
like the cooked down tomatoes. And the first time I heard of caponata, I was reading a magazine, this really wonderful, very small quarterly called The Art of Eating. And they had like this really long article about traveling and eating in Sicily and all the different dishes that the author had found. And one of these things was caponata. And he mentioned also that there's sometimes chocolate in it. And I remember just thinking that was so interesting and so unusual. And I ended up asking this woman, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who's a wonderful food writer who spent a lot of time in Italy, lives in Italy for much of the year. She has a daughter named Sarah Jenkins, who I know is a chef in New York City who has a terrific little pasta restaurant. And so I asked them about the chocolate in caponata. And they said this really interesting thing. And that was, well, Sicily, it's like a fertile island in the middle of the crossroads of like every civilization in that entire region.
Yes.
So Sicily has been conquered and reconquered by Arabs, Italians, Spanish, you know, like so many different societies over the years. And so for many, many, many years, it was ruled by the Spanish. During the time that the Spanish had colonized Mexico. And of course, Mexico is where chocolate is native. So, so what happened was the Spanish had been bringing the those like old forms of Mexican chocolate, you know, back to Europe, but also at that time back to Sicily. And so there's this really, really, you know, hundreds of years old tradition of chocolate making in Sicily. They don't grow cacao there, but they have chocolate making there. And there are very old chocolate factories in Sicily that make the chocolate in the way that was made back then. So it wasn't this smooth, you know, creamy, luscious chocolate that we have today.
Yes.
It's a little bit grainy. It's a little more rustic. It's usually like hand ground. It's a very like old style of chocolate. And some of that chocolate or some of the cocoa found its way into Sicilian dishes. And so that's kind of the answer as to how it got there. And now in terms of the taste and the flavor, you think about it, you have eggplant, which is sort of like rich because you've fried it in oil, and you have, you know, the sort of sweet tart thing with the tomatoes. You have the grassy vegetal flavors of the celery. And so to add a little bit of sweetness and to add a little bit of bitterness with cocoa, with chocolate, like it just rounds out all those flavors. So I would suggest trying it with the cocoa powder or with like grated dark chocolate, because I think it adds a really nice background note. It's not super prominent usually in most recipes, but it's just a little bit to give it a little bitterness and a little bit of, you know, just another dimension.
Wonderful history, too. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for the call. I hope you enjoy your caponata.
Yes, thank you. I certainly will. Thank you.
Take care.
Yeah, you too.
And remember, you can call us anytime. Questions or thoughts, 1-800-537-5252. About 12 years ago, beekeepers started noticing that their hives were getting a little bit weird. Bees were dying or just going missing, and it started to happen at shocking rates. And soon there was a panic, and scientists couldn't exactly understand why bee populations were seeming to just fall off a cliff. They called the mystery colony collapse disorder, and they started to imagine a world and a food system without bees. Over a decade later, thankfully we still have bees, but are we out of the woods? For an update on what's going on in bee health, we're turning to Bernardo Nino, who's a bee researcher at UC Davis. Hey, Bernardo, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with something really basic. Can you describe what a bee colony is?
So a bee colony is defined as really the bees in the colony, the comb, the developing bees. It's something that people use often interchangeably with hive, but the true definition of the hive is the bees plus the box, is just an easy way to put it.
So it's like a community of bees, like a city of bees. And what's a healthy one like? How does it develop?
So there's lots of ways, I guess, for hives and colonies to get started. But from a managed honeybee colony perspective, you could start in the spring either from packages, which is essentially like a shoebox full of bees, about 3 pounds of bees, plus a queen, and you literally shake the bees onto the equipment, and they will start drawing wax, and the queen will start laying eggs. The queen has the capacity to lay around 1,500 to maybe 2,000 eggs a day, and so the colony can grow quickly, especially if proper nutritional resources are in place. They generally forage on pollen to provide protein for the bees in the developing brood, and the nectar, which can be cured into honey, also supplies them their carbohydrates to help draw the wax out and basically survive. So the colony builds up. They can get to 50, 60,000 individuals in a colony, and then at that point, they can really be driven towards honey production, especially if there's enough resources and enough healthy bees. They can make a substantial amount of honey per colony. And then as the season progresses in different parts of the country, if the nutrition starts becoming restricted, their growth slows and their population declines, and they try to get to a reasonable amount of healthy bees to go through the winter. And obviously the winter can be very different across the country. And so a lot of the commercial beekeepers will actually move bees to warmer climates to overwinter them.
So part of the natural order, they will start to die off if you're going through the winter and the population size will contract.
Exactly.
So now what's colony collapse disorder?
So colony collapse disorder is actually defined as a syndrome. It has specific set of symptoms. It's often confused with colony decline or colony loss. A colony can fail from varroa mites or poor nutrition or a number of different reasons, but the colony collapse disorder is essentially the bees vanish. You have a lot of young bees, a queen, but the foragers are gone. A lot of the house bees are gone. There's a delayed onset of robbing where other bees will basically take the resources from a colony for their own, but there seems to be a delay in that. There's a delay in pests. There's no dead bees on the ground in front of the colony. So typically a pesticide kill or other things that can kill colonies, you would see dead bees in front of the colony. Colony collapse disorder, that's not the case. In addition, there's another criteria where you have low varroa mite and low Nosema levels. So all of these things have to really be in place to be defined as colony collapse disorder. And a lot of these are qualitative data, so it's also tricky to diagnose as well. And because there's no known cause of it, it's really disconcerting because, again, your bees just vanish.
Yeah. So we still don't know what the story is. Like, we still, I remember hearing for a while, people were saying, oh, no, it's our cell phones. You know, it's like screwing up their natural radar and they don't know how to find their way home. And then I was like, oh, my God, like cell phones are going to destroy all of civilization. You know, like.
Yes. No, I can say for certainty it's not cell phones. That was a very, I would say, poorly done study that was taken out of context and then kind of gobbled up by, I think, the popular media. But the general thought is it's a suite of effects happening synergistically that creates the perfect storm to have these bees decline. So maybe it's poor nutrition combined with pesticide exposure, combined with high viral levels within the colony. And so maybe one of these things acts as a tipping point, and then you have the colony collapse. But a relatively recent paper is discussing more along like the digestive tract, and I would say the gut health of the bees as potentially diagnostic.
And then from like a layperson's perspective, like, you know, for a while we were hearing these stories and it was very apocalyptic. It was very much like, oh my God, we're going to lose bees. They're going to go extinct and our food system's going to crumble. And I feel like I've been hearing that less and less. Is it just because we started ignoring it, or is it because there's actually, you know, we're finding ways to overcome it?
So I think the story is beekeepers, especially at the commercial level, are really finding ways to overcome this. And the reality is honeybees are not going extinct. We still experience high annual colony losses. They hover anywhere between 30 to 40%, which if you put that in context of other agricultural animals or other livestock, to lose 40% of the nation's cattle would be catastrophic. But that's an annual loss for honeybees, and the really good beekeepers are able to maintain and increase their numbers by splitting and doing some more complex management to make sure that we have enough colonies in the United States to carry out pollination services. I tell people it's tough being a honeybee colony in the United States. There's a lot of transportation involved that is stressful. The monoculture that's happening is challenging for the bees as well. Agricultural pesticides, in addition to some of the pesticides I have to put in my own colony to mitigate some of the pathogens. All of this is very challenging. So I would say it's not becoming easier to manage colonies, both commercially or at the backyard level. But it's something as we learn more and through research, we're able to equip beekeepers with tools to better manage their hives and to create scenarios where they're still able to be successful.
Well, that's good news.
Yes.
But then, you know, there are wild bees, too, and other pollinators as well. It's not just honeybees, right? So if people wanted to help, would using those pollinator houses that you find in gardening stores or like something like that, does that help?
Absolutely. So I feel that honeybees often get the spotlight as they're charismatic, they're easily managed compared to some of the native pollinators, and I would say non-apis pollinators. The non-apis pollinators are very important, both from a production standpoint and from just an ecological standpoint. One thing people can do is provide the bee hotels. Planting forage provides habitat for the non-apis pollinators as well. So flowers, blooming plants, they can be trees. Honeybees specifically do well with fruit trees. The forage mix would need to be a number of different plants because bees need different sources of pollen for their diverse nutrition. So planting a few different varieties, both for pollen and for nectar, would be ideal.
Well, it's great to know that there's something that regular people can do to help along. Thanks so much for coming in, Bernardo.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Bernardo Nino is the educational supervisor of the California Master Beekeeper Program at UC Davis, and he's the head of research and development at UBees. And that's our show for the week. And remember, take care of those bees, because
it goes from, what is it? To all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickle, onion on a sesame seed bun, to like a sad burger. Like that's all you'd have left is a sad burger without any bees.
Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. And if there's anything you heard here today that you'd like more info on, come on over to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can register for our monthly cookbook giveaway, rifle through our recipes, take a look at our videos, and sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about eating well Monday to Friday. If you don't subscribe to our podcast, please do. Our show is pulled together by senior producer Jennifer Russell with assistant producer Erica Romero. Jennifer Lubke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in, and I'm Francis Lamb. This is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.